David Byrne and St. Vincent with Ice Age. Their album Love This Giant is one of the albums of the week this week. And you're tuned in to the Final Draft Books and Writing on 2SER. I'm Genevieve McGregor. Last week we had some technical problems, some gremlins in the system, and this show didn't go to air. We hope you will forgive us, dear listeners. But of course, in our globe-trotting world, it's also a show about Australia, about the consuming nature of place, about living across two countries and two cultures, and about going away and coming home again, and dealing with the change that can bring. First up, intrepid foreign correspondent Iris Mackler chats with Will Mumford about her latest book, Hope Street Jerusalem, a look at the adventure and unpredictability of working as a correspondent in a consuming and dangerous place like Israel. Then Yasmin Parry caught up with Alice Malika Ugeze about her first novel, The Memory of Salt, a tale about family, Turkish culture and coming to terms with the past. All coming up, so stay tuned.
October's a time for celebrating, and there's no better place than The Loft. This week, Songs on Stage continue on Wednesday night before Oktoberfest on Thursday night with an Oompa Pa band and DJs until late. Friday, there'll be funky DJs all night long with super chunky funk and beats. Cheap drinks, great atmosphere, The Loft is for everyone. UTS Union is a sponsor of 2SER.
Iris Mackler has spent years reporting from the world's hotspots, including Baghdad, Gaza, Egypt, Chechnya, and Afghanistan. Her latest book is part journalist memoir, part ode to her adopted city of Jerusalem, and part love story. Hope Street Jerusalem details Mackler's life as a foreign correspondent in Israel in a post-September 11 political atmosphere. Will Mumford chatted to her about life, love, reporting and religion, and what it's like when you first arrive in a majestic city like Jerusalem.
You notice it from the first moment because it's the essence of Jerusalem. It's where all the Bible stories are set. Mm. So, you know, there King David built his temple. There Jesus walked, prayed, was crucified. There Muhammad rode to heaven on the wings of a horse. You know, these are the foundation myths, myth stories that we know from the Old Testament, the New Testament and the Quran. And they all happened there. And they all happened in 1 square kilometre in the centre of this tiny, mountain town. Mm. You'd never go to it for any other reason. You know, it's not on a highway. It's not on a water. Like, you know, people build cities for reasons usually. None of that with Jerusalem.
Does it feel transcendent in a way sometimes?
Yeah, especially in that old city, in that tiny area that is the foundation of all of this. Sometimes, you know, you turn a corner and you think, I could see Jesus, or I could see King Solomon, so wise he could understand the language of animals. And that's an extraordinary thing in the middle of a modern city. That's the old city of Jerusalem. And because of its religious importance, religion lives and breathes in a way it just doesn't in cities here and doesn't in many other cities in the world. I mean, there are other cities, Mecca, other cities where religion is very important. But because these are competing religions, you also feel that tension. So it's never a tension-free city. So it's incredibly beautiful, it's mystic, it's magical, and there's something poisoned there too. And you're aware of all those tensions as you walk around those amazing streets.
You say there is a great respect for satire, humour and the free press in Jerusalem. But there is also a strong, somewhat conservative religious element. What's it like to be a journalist over there?
It's a good place to be a journalist for many reasons. One is that lots of things happen, and the other is that you have a freedom to report. I've been a reporter in other places. I've lived in Russia, for example. You can't go off to Chechnya on your own like you can go off to the West Bank when things are happening on your own. You know, you may meet Israeli soldiers who won't let you go one way, you go another, and you're not accompanied by soldiers. So you have an enormous freedom to report that you don't have in other places. There is a censorship, which, you know, no one has ever come and told me what to write and what not to write, I have to say. So it's a paradoxical thing. There is a great, thriving, living, breathing, kicking free press in Israel. And that enables you to do your job, to report on things that aren't free. But you are free to work.
The first chapter in the book tells the story of when you were at a protest and were hit in the jaw by a rock. And it sounds like it was a fairly traumatic experience. Did that shake you at all?
Yeah, it really did shake me. First of all, my jaw was broken in 3 places and there was extensive nerve damage. And it wasn't clear if I was going to be able to drink without dribbling or to smile again. And I thought, that's a big price to pay, a frozen face, you know. So there was just, that took a long time. My jaw was wired shut for 6 weeks and all that time I didn't know if I'd get better.
And you were, I mean, what's it like to have something like that happen to you but not be, you know, in your hometown with your family, not be able to, you know, communicate with people that you
It's very lonely.
You're very familiar with, yeah.
It's a I can't tell you that, I can't think of many things more lonely than being injured when you're not in the place where you speak the language, know the culture, have your family around you. And I stayed I feel that I was lucky to be injured in Jerusalem where the standard of medical care is so high. I could have been in Baghdad or I could have been in Afghanistan. So I was treated quickly and I was treated well. So the medical care was good, but I still felt really lonely. And that whole long time, not knowing if I would recover. And it had a psychological effect too, because I think what enables us to do this job and to go out to these dangerous places is some strange sense of invulnerability. You don't think it's going to happen to you, even as you see it happening to your friends all around you. And when it does happen to you, that mask that let you go on, that veil that let you do the job is taken away, and you suddenly realise that you're not invulnerable and that you might have a lifelong injury.
When do you sleep?
You don't sleep much. And in this 24/7 news environment, you really don't sleep much. And I file to different broadcasters all around the world because I'm freelance. So the people in Australia, who are waking you at 6 a.m. don't care that you've been filing for a European broadcast until 2 a.m. They just don't care, you know. They're on Australian time, and why aren't you on and they expect you to be on Australian time.
Yeah.
And you have to be on Australian time, even though you also have to work on European time and Canadian time, or wherever else you file.
So the sun never sets for a foreign correspondent.
No, it's very tiring. It's a very tiring job, actually. And it really is 24/7, and that's why I think so many female journalists have no private life. Mm. Because it sucks you in to working 24/7 and giving yourself to that job 24/7.
There's only a small section on your father, but you describe him as handsome, charming, charismatic, but also erratic, aggressive, and often violent. Could you tell us a little bit about him?
Yeah, I didn't have an easy childhood. Mm. I didn't, I guess. Although many of my memories are happy, my memories of my father aren't happy. And does that make me the kind of woman who goes out and do these things? I don't know. You know, I don't know about the connection between an unhappy childhood and seeking out this kind of excitement later in life. I don't know. In some ways, I guess it's something that many women would know, you know, and people know an absent father. If you're not lucky enough to have a loving and involved father, there's the model of an absent father, or there's the model of a violent father. Mm. You know, so I guess I had a little bit of each, and it really wasn't easy.
Was this the first time you'd written about
it? Yeah, yeah. In fact, this is the most personal book that I've written. I've written other things, and of course, I work as a reporter, and it's quite hard. Maybe it's just hard if you're an old-fashioned reporter, you know, it's just the facts, ma'am, and the story. To make yourself the story is actually quite hard.
Early in the book, you visit an Irish priest, Father Fergus Clark, in the Old City, and he speaks of his optimism that the three monotheisms will one day, you know, live in harmony. You write, I looked at him in disbelief. Outside the church, the sons of Abraham were trying to kill each other. He was telling me that external reality didn't matter. Is that metaphysical perspective or philosophy a strange thing to comprehend as a journalist?
That's a very good question, because it's exactly, you've hit on the heart of the conundrum of reporting from a place where the internal world, the religious precepts, that belief is actually stronger than external reality. So you are there to report on external reality, and people say to you, you know, but in the Bible, you think, well, the Bible is a book from a long time ago, and we're talking about now. But the Bible is as real to the person who's talking to you as the external reality. And I have just learnt, you know, we're a very secular country here in Australia, and I'm a very secular person. So this has really been a learning experience, to be in a place where everyone is governed by something else that is not actually comprehensible to me.
The book talks about how you found Raphael, your boyfriend, and also your dog Mia, and it seems as if this experience was what, I guess, made you go from just being a foreign correspondent at work to really becoming, a citizen of Jerusalem.
Well, I don't know if I'm a citizen of Jerusalem. I still feel like an observer. No, it's interesting because I've been there a long time. That's actually a good question. And this book, I wrote this book because I was at this fork in the road, I guess, and I came back to the things that other people just take for granted, a boyfriend, a dog, and I realised that, you know, I'd got to this stage where there was no room for anything in my life but work. There was no work-life balance. There was no balance. It was just all work. And it's a fascinating job. So you can be really sucked into just... Mm. And then one day I thought, oh, my God, I don't have... All my stuff is in... I don't have an apartment. All my things are in storage somewhere else. I don't have a boyfriend. I don't have a dog. I don't even have houseplants. You know, I can't make a commitment to a houseplant just in case I have to go to Baghdad tomorrow. And I thought, this is not really a life. And I began to feel that I was observing other people's lives rather than living my own. And along came love.
Thank you.
Listening to The Final Draft, and that was Beirut with Riptide.
In Conversation, a new Q&A event with interesting people from around the world. The first is with New York's Lee Ranaldo, best known for redefining the parameters of rock music in Sonic Youth. Lee will be in conversation with 2SER Music Director Andrew Kaduri, after which questions for Lee will be taken from the audience. In Conversation with Lee Ranaldo is at 7 p.m. Friday, October 19 at The Green Room, 156 Enmore Road, Enmore. In Conversation is free, but capacity is limited and restricted to over 18s only. Reserve your place by emailing inconversation@2scr.com. In Conversation with Lee Ranaldo, 7 p.m. Friday, October 19 at The Green Room, 156 Enmore Road, Enmore. Brought to you by 2SER and Groove Scooter.
Ali's mother is an Australian doctor working in Afghanistan when she meets Ali's father, an enigmatic Turkish circus musician. They travel across many countries to be together, but the great adventure of their love is fraught with problems. And so Ali grows up in Melbourne, reflecting on the past, torn between a patient but fraying mother and a virtuistic but tormented father, a man who serenades his wife, plays the trumpet and the saz, scribbles phrases from the Quran across the city, and hears voices that urge him to violence. The Memory of Salt is Alice's first novel, and Yasmin called her to talk about family, Turkish culture, and the similarities between Ali's story and her own.
Ali was a way of sort of trying to grow myself up textually or something. In terms of the gender thing, like that's one thing I guess I found freeing up. Initially, the Ali character was explicitly a female, and I found in my final draftings of it last year, I found that really just claustrophobic or limiting. I just couldn't write that character. They couldn't get off the page. They wouldn't become four-dimensional. Yeah, in terms of taking away that fixed gender, I don't know, maybe more similarities came out between myself and Ali. I guess when it comes to Ali, most of the experiences there that Ali's had, I've had, not all of them, but most of them, you know, truth and fiction and all this is, it's all such choppy water and it's all the lines are so blurry. But things that didn't necessarily exactly happen to myself that happened to Ali could have happened to me. So I guess Ali's like my sort of twin brother / sister. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. Yeah. I was wondering, you know, writing from Ali's perspective is one thing, but then you also write from Ali's parents' perspective or Ali looking back. Was that an interesting or a difficult thing for you, writing your parents' lives and their past and history?
Yeah, it was. Trying to imagine my way into, like, them in the 70s, I felt was hard. I felt it was hard to get the real depth of layers and visceralness and real authenticity. I mean, I had no problem imagining it all, but I felt like it's got quite a different weight to the rest of the book. You know, having to write a sex scene was that just really... like, I remember, you know, Ivor, I think, hinting at me last year, you know, somehow, you're going to have to get them together or something. And I was like, oh, God. So that was a bit much. And at one point, I was reading some of my novel to my mum and we were just picking random pages, or she'd pick random pages out of the air, and she picked that one, a sex scene. I was like, oh, fuck. So I had to read it to her. So that was difficult. But I just tried to keep it really kind of poetic and a bit abstruse.
And how did your parents feel about the book? Were they, you know, sort of touched that you had, you know, taken their lives and your life and put it in this creative context?
I think so, definitely, yeah. Yeah, they're proud of me. It feels like there's kind of little choice. Mm. Like, you know, I mean, maybe if I was kind of built differently, I'd do something different. But I think they understand that I was compelled and they sort of blessed it. And, yeah, they're happy about it. Mm. So that's good. And it's a book of love, you know, it's a sort of homage to them. So
I mean, I found that, like, the story, it's one of mental illness and of a family kind of falling apart in some ways, but it's told in this loving and poetic way. And I wondered, was it hard writing about, you know, those hard realities of life, of family, which can be terrible, but it's also about commitment and love and happiness and sticking by each other. Was that difficult for you to sort of to walk that line?
Yeah, it was difficult. It was difficult as well to present stuff to people, that like the hard stuff. There's part of me that's like, well, actually it was a lot harder than that, like I kind of softened it. To try and dress up these difficult experiences, to make them poetic, to make them readable, that was quite difficult. I remember talking to my supervisor in my master's and she said that most writers don't write about their parents until they're dead. I feel very protective of them. It's a funny sort of line of wanting to tell stories and be really open, but at the same time being quite protective.
Tell me about your life growing up in Melbourne and travelling to Turkey. How did you experience those two very different places and how did they affect your writing?
Well, I grew up in Melbourne in an area that was in the 80s predominantly migrant, and lots of Turks, lots of Lebanese, lots of Italians. So all my Turkish family were in Turkey and I didn't meet them until I was like 15 or so. So I grew up experiencing Turkishness on the one hand through migrant diasporas in Melbourne and travelling back and forth. Yeah, I went the first time when I was 15, I'd wanted to go earlier. My mum had wanted to take me when I was a baby, but there was almost civil wars happening and Kurdish and Turkish stuff going on, and it was pretty dangerous, like I've been told, in the early 80s. So I grew up with a longing, I guess, and a little bit of a sense of displacement and not quite fitting in, and who are these other people and where are they and what is it? And I, you know, nobody used my middle name when I was growing up. I didn't know how to say it or what it meant. So it was a bit of a mystery. So travelling back was kind of decoding part of myself.
So is the book a bit of an exploration of your own culture and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I guess so. I'm one of those writers who's, since my first day of school, I came home and told my mother that I hated it because they didn't teach me how to write and read. Mm. So writing for me is like gravity, it's like breathing, it's something I've always done. And so when it came to exploring the other side of my family, I guess the most natural thing was to write about it. And it wasn't really a novel until quite some years after I'd started it. yeah, it just grew and grew sort of around me.
In the book, there's a lot of different languages that are threaded through: English, German and Turkish, and they're spoken and then they're gone again. And sometimes you don't get a really explicit explanation of what exactly what was said. And I found that a really, really interesting experience and really immersive. And so what effect were you trying to create by including all those languages?
I guess really I was being authentic to the experience. You know, it's a challenging experience being in that sort of context of having four languages sort of spoken around oneself and not understanding everything. So I wanted the reader to have the experience of Ali. But I spoke to Ivor about it a lot, like, what should we do? How should we, you know, help readers out with this? I was thinking originally of doing something like Orhan Pamuk had done. He's a Turkish Nobel Prize winning author, and he often has a little key at the start where he'll explain the pronunciation of various letters in the Turkish alphabet because they are quite different. And Ivor said, no, let's not worry about that. Don't worry about it. Just leave it. And I said, oh, well, how are we going to have a glossary? What are we going to do? And he just kind of said, just leave it. Don't worry about it. And I wasn't entirely sure about that. But the translations are actually there. Everything is translated. It's just so embedded in the text directly sort of around it. Or the other languages are couched in translation. It's just that you might not necessarily know.
Absolutely. I felt like you really got the sense of understanding of what was going on without being explicitly told in English.
Yeah, yeah. Because people have said, oh, it's not translated. And I'm like, well, it is, but you just don't know.
Yeah.
But I think it's also important for the different musicality and the different kind of texture that you're around, you know, when you're in another country and around other languages.
Yeah.
You know, it just adds a depth, I think, to the texture. Yeah.
The book's really visceral and tactile in a lot of ways, like that, with language and food and music seemed really important to me as well. Can you tell me about the significance of music to you and to the book?
I grew up being trained as a musician from a very young age, so it's in me and through me. Like, I grew up going to piano lessons when I was five with this wonderful old eccentric lady in Glenroy. I grew up with guitar, singing, flute, accordion, this kind of thing. And obviously my father is a musician, so I grew up with his music as well. I feel like there's a musician in me who chose a pen instead, if you could put it like that. The rhythms of the music I grew up with come out in the rhythms of my writing. I grew up with my dad's sort of music as well as my classical training, and his music was sort of playing, you know, Hijaz and Bayati and Eastern scales on, for example, the trumpet. Yeah, my mum was telling me the other night, she's like, you know, he was doing world music well before there was even such a term. So music's a place of really meeting and languages merging and cross-hatching. But I don't play so much anymore these days. I feel, yeah, that I'm a sort of music who plays with a pen or something.
The book's called The Memory of Salt. What's the significance of salt?
Well, when I was going through titles, I did a word search of salt in my novel when it was a document, and it was just a million times. It occurred so many times, and I looked at all the different contexts and sort of was faced with this mirror of myself going, oh my gosh, what am I talking about? And it is very instinctive, but salt has a very particular role in mysticism, in Islamic mysticism, in Sufism, in terms of also that area where my family come from. Salt's symbolic nature in adages, phrases. It occurs as a symbol of binding people together, of deep sort of alchemical principles, of history. It's kind of the glue that sticks blood together or people together.
And that's all we have time for tonight. Thanks for listening.
I love that 2SER, I can come in here after a day's work and present a show and do a segment, and that anyone can be a participant.
I love 2SER because I can get naked to it.
I love vegan cake.
I love that it's something that I can contribute to, and that it's local, it's accessible, and we are able to talk about things that are important to us.
Share the love. Support Real Radio.